it's not just technology, but technology is like the vector of status, significance, provision, importance, confidence that you're making a difference in the world. And our devices in all kinds of ways now are like tuned, incredibly tuned to give us that sense of significance. A friend of mine just said something quite profound. He'd just been away for a week in nature with his kids. And he came back, he said, you know, when you're in front of the screen, you feel so big. You're so big in comparison to the screen. The screen is also designed to magnify your sense of importance. And he said, but I get out in nature and I feel so small. And paradoxically, it actually feels better to feel small than feel big, at least in the long run.
Lewis also writes in his book, Abolition of Man, which is a wonderful book about personhood. He has a couple of authors that he's arguing against. He disguises them in that book. But one of the statements of theirs that he cites is they say, when we're seeing a great sight of nature, it makes us feel large and sublime. And he says, no. When we see the largeness of nature, it actually makes us feel small and humble. We got to get out more. We're learning together how to move from a life that is just phone-based, screen-based, captured in too much by the online world, to God's world, to the kingdom of God, to the fullness of personhood. And I'm not sure there's a human being on the planet that I would rather have a conversation with about that topic than Andy Crouch. Andy, thank you so much for joining me on Become New.
Well, it is a pleasure. Thank you.
Andy's kind of grinning, I think, partly because I told him I owe him an apology. We're like super late. I've wasted half an hour of his day, and this is a wonderful way to enter into the technology issue. I got a double tech problem today. One of them is I got a note a couple days ago. For the second time, my Google password had been compromised, and I'm working with somebody new, so we shift the Google password. But what that meant was my phone is no longer able to access emails, Gmails, or my calendar. So
The promises of technology are breaking down in real time as we record.
So that's one problem. The other problem is when I went downstairs this morning, not long before our interview was supposed to start, I saw that my wife had left her phone in the garage. And that was a problem because we have a big birthday for our little three-year-old friend today. And she's at a yoga class right now and then had work stuff and things where I knew she would need her phone. And my first thought was, I will text Nancy and tell her that her phone is here. And then, of course, I realized it would be difficult for her to receive a text when she doesn't actually have her phone because we don't have chips for that. This is like multiple meltdowns on the tech level. And it was a very stark reminder, Andy, we'll just kind of get into this stuff, about how dependent we have become on technology for daily life. Your thoughts?
Imagine trying to explain to your grandparents the problems that you've had this morning. And then they would say, well, but why do you need all that? And you'd try to explain how easy it makes life most of the time. It would be very hard to explain these problems. The existential level of dread when you realize your phone is not where you expect it to be. Yeah, it'd be very hard to explain that to any other generation, but here we are. Everyone will understand.
We are, and I'm very grateful to you. For everybody listening, Andy has been a friend for many years. We were on the board together at Fuller Seminary for a long time. He is just one of the best writers and voices and minds to think about faith and life in our time. There are a few authors that on my bookshelves have their own space where just their books are clumped together under their name. C.S. Lewis and the other Inklings, Eugene Peterson.
Are the rest organized by color or?
Dallas Willard. No, although when I was living in the cabana, some of the Become New team actually came in and I just had a small assortment of book there and they assorted them by color there. So here it's generally topic, but a couple of other guys, Lou Smeeds, Neil Planiga, N.T. Wright, they get their own just shelf space, and Andy Crouch is one of those guys. And I will say two of the books that for sure you want to get, The TechWise Family, talk a little bit about that. And then this might be my favorite of Andy's books, the life we're looking for, reclaiming relationship in a technological world, and they are immensely packed with wisdom. In the TechWise family, Andy, you note that Sherry, is it pronounced Turkle, Turkel?
Turkle.
Turkle.
Yes, Sherry Turkle from MIT.
Writes that most conversations take at least 7 minutes to begin. Up till then, we're able to rely on our usual repertoire of topics. And so that's part of why the risks of exposure and giving time to conversation that we often don't do when it's done via technology, rather embodied, can be a difficulty. I hope that our conversation begins even sooner than the 7 minute point.
Yes, exactly. And well, and the punchline of that observation from her is that in her lab, or you know, these environments where she studies how people interact with media and phones and so forth, it is at the 7 minute mark that people pull out their phones and just check to see maybe there's something else happening. And that becomes a signal to the other person.
Yeah.
I'm not fully here. I'm not actually going to take that risk that takes the conversation deeper. And so I promise I will not pull out my phone at the 7 minute mark of this conversation.
That's true.
I'm not checking my email right now. You are the only person in my world right now, John.
Two of the other glitches going on today. One of them is that although this is being recorded for everybody who is listening or watching right now, Andy cannot see my face. The way in which he would do that is blacked out, so he can't. And on my computer, there's a little screen that says your recording has stopped. That is an incorrect error. But what it means is, Andy, I can see your forehead and I can see your chin, but it looks like you're in a witness protection program because your actual eyes and nose are completely blacked out.
Oh man! We're doing this very impaired. It may actually be who knows what could come of this. It may be the best conversation ever.
So far, I'm liking it quite a lot because it does at least feel real. The folks who listen to Become New, and we've just become kind of a community online, and doing this series where we're looking at the relationship of spirituality and technology. A very fundamental part of it has involved the 10 TechWise commitments that you talk about in the TechWise family. And in particular, that were designed for a rhythm of work and rest. And so 1 hour a day, 1 day a week, 1 week a year without our devices. And then the daily rhythm, we wake up before our devices do and spend some time awake without them. And then our devices go to bed before we do. And then that notion of accountability, where both parents with children, but then I think for adults as well, I have my friend Rick, where there's an accountability relationship, and we give passwords and access. But each one of those commitments is so helpful. Say a little bit about where they come from, what your response has been from other people, what's it like for you to implement them, and so. And do you have a favorite? Is there one in particular you find most helpful?
I do have a favorite, and it's sort of implied in the second one, and I'll explain in a moment. These all came out of mistakes and missteps and often loving interventions by my wife, Catherine. So my wife is a physicist, an experimental physicist. And she works with the highest technology you can imagine in her lab, like optical tables and lasers and crazy stuff. But she's actually so much more sane than I am about technology in our home. And as we were getting to know each other in the context of marriage and then raising kids, I did not come into this marriage with a healthy set of practices for tech. I am... by nature, I think kind of a geek. I love the stuff. My dad brought home a very early terminal, they were called. This will be like ancient history to almost everyone, but this way that you dialed up to the mainframe computer at the university he was teaching at when I was 10 years old or 11 years old. And I was absolutely hooked on hooked on the magic that you can do with technology, as well as the what it opens up that's possible. And in a lot of ways, that's really good. And, so I don't regret the years I spent coding and learning to code and spending lots of time on computers in various ways. But in the context of the home, it wasn't always helpful. And so each one of these 10 commitments is something I had to learn. And I had to learn to have a rhythm of work and rest, that is to really disengage from all these things that it's not just technology, but technology is like the vector of status, significance, provision, mm-hmm. importance, confidence that you're making a difference in the world. And our mm-hmm. devices in all kinds of ways now are like tuned, incredibly tuned to give us that sense of significance. A friend of mine just said something quite profound. He'd just been away for a week in nature with his kids. And he came back, he said, you know, when you're in front of the screen, you feel so big. You're so big in comparison to the screen. The screen is also designed to magnify your sense of importance. And he said, but I get out in nature and I feel so small. And paradoxically, it actually feels better to feel small than mm-hmm. feel big, at least in the long run. So this kind of daily rhythm of, you know, put the devices to bed. I think the big breakthrough when we realize no one in our house needs or should have a screen in the bedroom, certainly not the kids. There's a whole additional set of reasons it's really bad for adolescents to have screens with them, but the parents as well. And that we should wake up in the morning and not go downstairs and first thing we do, like pick up the glowing rectangle. And the big breakthrough for me was, and this is my favorite thing that I do, is it was the decision to actually go out of doors every morning before I look at any screen. And I did that this morning. I've done it every morning, almost without exception, for probably 8 years now. I started doing it actually while I was writing TechWise Family. And it is some measure, I think, of my, what a beginner I am in the spiritual life, that this very simple discipline, do not imagine that I go outdoors and have like an hour of centering prayer or something like that outside. What I do is I open the front door of our house. We live in a little town in southeastern Pennsylvania. I walk out under the front step and I stand there for some amount of time, sometimes very short. This morning was probably only 20 seconds.
But even in the winter, you will do that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Every single day, whatever the weather, I've done it from like the 30th floor of hotels in Hong Kong, you know, like find a way downstairs. The rule is get out of doors before you open up any, let anything glow at you, get out into the world. And I have to tell you, it's been spiritually revolutionary.
Wow.
To begin my day, very much as my friend said, you walk out, the moment you walk out of your house or your apartment or whatever, you just suddenly feel smaller and yet more real, less anxious. Your senses awaken. There's always smells out there, aromas, odors sometimes. There's sounds you don't hear inside a kind of conditioned environment. There's a temperature difference. This morning was horribly humid outside. I go out and I almost every morning, kind of by instinct, I say, thank you, God, for this day. And I have to say, I walked out into this very humid July afternoon or morning in Pennsylvania, and I had a hard time thanking God for the level of humidity.
Yeah. God, what were you thinking? This might be a psalm of lament.
Exactly. But I will also say the first 2 weeks that I started doing this, it was a ridiculous spiritual battle to not pick up my phone, because my routine had been, I went downstairs, the phones all stay in the kitchen, I start making my tea and I pick up my phone and see what notifications I have, which it's truly a horrible way to begin the day, but it is what I was doing. And the first 2 weeks that I tried this new thing, I felt this absurd level of temptation and almost like the phone was calling to me, like, Andy, don't you need me? Don't you want to check me? I've got something for you. And I had to sort of almost verbally say, no, like stay in your holster. And 2 weeks in, one day it completely flipped. And I still heard this little voice kind of whispering, you know, Andy, don't you want to check me? And instead of feeling drawn or seduced or kind of pulled in, I just felt total revulsion. I was like, why in the world would I check you when there's a world to check in about? And it's never even been an issue of temptation since then. But for 2 weeks, it was a spiritual battle. Crazy, like absurd spiritual battle. And yet very illuminating, right? Of how dependent we become on these patterns and how these devices offer us something that we kind of want, but that actually robs us of what we really want, which is to be connected to God, the world, others, self, and not need these very impersonal things.
Well, two thoughts from C.S. Lewis that sparks, and then we'll lead to another question. In his book, Abolition of Man, which is a wonderful book about personhood, and in your writings, particularly in the life that we're looking for, you talk a lot about what does it mean to be a person, and how do we understand that, particularly as persons of faith, and how Christianity has impacted that. But he has a couple of authors that he's arguing against. He disguises them in that book. But one of the statements of theirs that he cites is, they say, when we're seeing a great sight of nature, it makes us feel large and sublime. And he says, no. When we see the largeness of nature, it actually makes us feel small and humble. And Nancy and I just got back from Yosemite, and one day we hiked up to Nevada Falls, and standing there and just watching those massive amounts of water, you know, flowing over the rock, and it's huge. And Nancy had told me about Bridal Veil Falls, and that it's actually called Bridal Veil because the water comes gushing over, it looks a bit like a veil. Yeah. And then when the wind is strong, it pushes it back like the veil of a bride being pushed back. I took video. I don't know. I'll send it to the team, and we might be able to show that with us, because it's actually, I thought she was just woman-splaining, but it was literally true. And it made us feel very small, but in a wonderful, wonderful way.
In a wonderful way.
Yeah. So then the other statement that you made that I'd love to hear you comment on is, technology has a kind of magic to it, and that it promises something that is kind of magical. And Lewis also writes, I forget where, about if we think about science and faith and magic, and ask, like the old Sesame Street song, which one of these is not like the other? Most people would say, faith and magic are more alike, because they agree there's some kind of supernatural, or, you know, some kind of non-scientific powers in the world. But he says, actually, in a very fundamental way, science and magic are more like each other. Because in the quest for how do I experience a good life, the good life, what both science and magic say is the key is changing the world outside me, around me, changing my circumstances, making goodness more available through alchemy, turning everything to gold, or through science. And what faith says is, no, what's really required is a change within me, that I must be transformed. And that in some ways, technology is what Lewis feared most. It's almost the blending of science and magic together in offering the life. You have a wonderful section where you talk about the Sorcerer's Apprentice, and where you kind of bring magic and technology together. And unless you've completely forgotten about that, I'll have that happen sometimes. Somebody will ask me about a book. I have no idea. I've forgotten it. So if you forgot it, it's okay. But if you remember, I'd love to hear you talk about that, because it was so powerful.
I have not forgotten it, because I would say it feels like one of the major discoveries of my own kind of intellectual journey, trying to figure out really what is happening with technology, like what's going on with this thing that we call technology, that we all know is very important, that we all feel very grateful for, and that we, interestingly, these days all feel very conflicted about. And the great discovery was, magic is the dream behind technology. And I mean magic in the sense that traces itself back through alchemy. And the other interesting discovery, I sort of came to this conviction gradually and I think independently, but then I realized Lewis saw all of this. And he saw this, you know, we're now almost 100 years or 80 years after his most active years. And he already saw that, as you said, science, which at the heart is the disciplined investigation of the natural world, the world that kind of presents itself to our senses, has been yoked in the West to this other thing, which really comes through the alchemical tradition, the alchemy tradition. In fact, you know, you hear alchemy and you probably also hear chemistry, right? They come from the same Arabic root. And we think chemistry is like this neutral thing and alchemy is the magical thing. But when you go not very far back in the history of science, it turns out that the people trying to do chemistry were actually, what they actually were mostly doing was alchemy. They were trying to turn all substance, all metals into gold, because that the one who would have infinite gold would have infinite power. And they were trying to develop the Philosopher's Stone, which would do that. And also, the possessor of the Philosopher's Stone would not die. They were trying to escape the conditions of mortality. And this dream has been present long before we figured out any chemistry, long before we really understood what we've come to understand about the kind of beautifully ordered kind of properties and in a way, natural laws of the natural world. This dream of being able to control it, to bend it to our uses, and to give us what I call in that book, The Life We're Looking For, effortless power. Mm-hmm. That is, no longer to bring about a change in the world would I have to exert myself physically or do actual kind of work. I would just have to speak a spell or utter an incantation or put together the right combination of substances in a pot or something, right? And then out would pop this incredible amount of power over the world and over other people. Mm-hmm. Lewis has this incredibly haunting phrase. I think it's in The Abolition of Man, where he says, the quest for domination over nature in science is not actually the quest for that. It's the quest for some men to dominate other men. He's speaking using his own kind of masculine generic language of his time. It's not the quest to dominate nature. It's the quest for some men to dominate other men. We're not looking for man's mastery of nature. We're looking for man's mastery of man.
Wow.
And that magical dream, when we start to figure it out, we have Francis Bacon at the dawn of the scientific revolution saying, gosh, if we could actually get nature, if we could compel nature to reveal her secrets, we would be able to relieve the human estate, which he's basically saying we'd be able to eliminate suffering. But at the same time, Goethe, the great German poet, writes down this little ballad that we call The Sorcerer's Apprentice in English. And it's the story of someone who does acquire that kind of power, but without wisdom, without character, and finds that actually there's this famous line that even today all German speakers learn this line. The spirits that I've summoned, I cannot now banish. The things that I sort of bring into being through my quest for magic take over and start to control my world.
Say that line one more time, Andy. The spirits that I have summoned.
The spirits I have summoned, I can now no longer banish. I can't get rid of them. This is when the broom multiplies, right? And the brooms all start doing their thing. So that sense, oh, we've conjured up something that we thought would give us effortless power of the world, but it's actually diminishing us. It's actually taking over our lives. It's actually reducing our humanity rather than giving us proper humanity. And Goethe saw all this coming, as poets sometimes do, at the turn of the 19th century.
And part of what that gets to then in being diminished or being enhanced is the issue of personhood. And what does it mean to be a person? And how do persons flourish, and how does technology help that, and when can that be interfered with? And you write about thinking about person from the perspective of the scriptures, and particularly those commands to love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind and all your strength. And personhood is becoming an increasingly fuzzy concept. People wonder, is an animal, is our pet, as much as we love it, a member of the family? Am I a parent to my pet? So are pets people, or is that speciesism? And then, of course, with technology and artificial intelligence, will that become a person?
Yeah.
So say a bit about personhood. Why is it so central to Christian faith and flourishing, and how do we enhance it?
Yeah. Well, there's multiple ways into this conversation about what is a person. And, as a total aside, it is fascinating. I'm starting to see bumper stickers and t-shirts that say, I'm a dog grandma or I'm a dog grandpa.
Right.
And the elevation actually of pets, as our world has fewer children, unfortunately, and fewer babies. The average woman in almost every country in the world has fewer children at the end of her childbearing years than she wishes she has had, that she would have liked to have had. And the average man is father to fewer children than he would have liked. So there's this gap between what people themselves say they wish had been true of their lives and what ends up being true. So the rise of art of kind of person substitutes to fill a world that has fewer persons in it and fewer personal relationships. So that Mark Zuckerberg goes on Twarkish Patel's podcast and says, you know, we know that the average person wants 12 friends, but they only have three. So couldn't AI give you the other nine? And can't Meta and Facebook give you the other nine? And he seems unable to consider that perhaps the rise of Facebook, now called Meta, is actually the reason we have that gap between 12 and 3.
And it would have been odd if Jesus would have had Peter, James, and John, and then nine chatbots.
nine chatbot followers. Oh, my gosh. Anyway, I think, you know, these are deep philosophical waters, and I've waded into them in my own reading. But in the end, I found it was most helpful to go back to Jesus's own definition of human flourishing. And, you know, when you say human flourishing, you're really speaking in Greek philosophical categories. This goes back to Aristotle's idea of eudaimonia, sometimes translated happiness, but it really means something deeper than that. But that's not a Jewish way of thinking. The Jewish way of asking the question of human flourishing is, what is the greatest commandment? Because the commandments are seen by faithful Jews as God's kind of deposit of opportunity to live the fully human life that otherwise would have been lost, but has been given especially to the Jewish people in Scripture and Torah. And so the way you ask the question, like, what's the ultimate good of human life, is to ask, what's the greatest commandment? What's of all the, you know, hundreds of specific kind of commands in Torah, which one sums it up? And Jesus, unlike almost every other time, he actually gives the expected answer and says, it's to love the Lord your God with your heart, your soul, your mind, and your strength. And this led me to suggest that in that book, and to really believe that the best way for us functionally to think about a person is a heart, soul, mind, strength complex designed for love. That what is it to be us? It is that we have heart, which is kind of emotion that animates our will. We have soul, which is depth of self that is able to connect to the depth of others and the depth that is God. This is, I think, what is not fully present in even our domesticated animals. I think there's your dog definitely pays attention to you and definitely wants to connect with you. But there's a limit in the depth of an animal's ensoulment. I wouldn't say, I'm not sure they have no soul, but they don't have the kind of depth that the image bearers do that enables us to connect deeply to other human beings, but above all, deeply to the one who made us. And then mind, capacity to reason and think, and then strength. We're created with bodies. We're created with bodies that can actually develop capacity. And this word that's in the Shema, you know, the section that Jesus quotes, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, also kind of gives this sort of developmental vision of what it is to be a person, that you could live with less than all. You could be small-hearted, you could be small-souled, you could be small-minded, you could be of limited strength, or you could become, in the course of life, in the course of responding to the challenges and gifts of life, someone who could love with allness of soul, of heart, of mind, of strength. And so it's both a kind of, you know, sort of functional way of thinking about it, but it's also an invitation. And I try to pay attention to this. Like, what am I doing today that will develop my allness of heart, that will expand my emotional range? What am I doing that expands my mind? What am I doing that expands my strength? One of the biggest effects of technology has been to attenuate our experience of life in the body such that you can go through what seems like a very satisfying day in front of screens and never put any load on your muscles, never ask your heart to rise above its resting rate. And it turns out it's really bad for human beings. And so we really need to be building sort of plans for allness of heart, soul, mind, and strength. And that puts us very much at cross purposes to what technology kind of invites us to do with our lives.
I had never thought about thinking about the Hebrew approach to human flourishing being expressed in the question, what is the greatest command?
Hmm.
And that's a wonderful thought, because in addition to reflections on flourishing, it captures that notion that it requires God, that it must be something that is God-centered, God-focused, God-directed. And there's a certain obligation to it. Tyler Vanderweil at Harvard this last year has come out with a book, Theology of Health.
Incredible book.
Isn't it? And part of what, you know, at the core of it is really there's basically two different ways to think about health. One is just to ask what's normal.
Yeah.
And then to say we should move, you know, that injury and disease are abnormal and we should move to what's normal. But of course, there's all kinds of problems with that. Because there can be many, many dimensions, including aging and death are normal. You know, they're statistically very, very frequent, but we wouldn't want to say that they're healthy. So then the only other way to approach it, he says, is to look at human beings having a telos, a purpose for which they were created.
Yes.
And that to health means to be healthy, to have health or wholeness or to flourish means moving towards that for which I was created. But then that means there is a creator and I have a certain obligation to him. And that, so the robustness of thinking at the core of life to ask what is the great commandment is a wonderful way to capture that.
Huh. And to kind of tie this back to our, in a way, our previous topic, what were you created to do magic? You know, were you created to have effortless power? And I think there's a naive kind of Christian idea that says, oh yeah, we're meant to, like, you know, pray prayers that move mountains and heal the sick and so forth. And the biblical answer, I mean, first of all, it is interesting the Bible does address magic at various points and not in positive terms. Like when you try to circumvent your created limitations and communicate with the dead, or, you know, there's a magician who follows Paul, I think it's Paul or Peter, around in Acts and tries to do the same stuff.
Yeah, Simon Magnus.
Simon Magus.
Can I purchase the spirit from you? Yeah.
And the Bible is just over and over says, no, that's not the way you get power. The way you get power is actually by being fully a person. Who is the one who is able with a word to heal? Who says, even as he's about to go to the cross, you know, I could just call 12 legions of angels right now. It's the incarnate Son of God who nonetheless has fully embraced to an extraordinary extent the limitations of being human, but has also embraced the Torah, the greatest commandment, and has become full of love such that his life is a completely flourishing life that I would say never does any magic and certainly never uses any technology. One thing that I find so fascinating about this, there's kind of two primal technologies, two early ways we figured out kind of to do magic in the world. And one is writing, which allows you to, you know, normally in kind of the long story of human existence, the way we communicate is we speak to one another. But what if you could put your speech onto a piece of paper and it could somehow travel the world without you? That's writing. The other is money, which transmutes the creation of value in the world, which primarily comes through agriculture and the harvesting of the goods of the world. It comes from working the land and being in a relationship in a way with the land. But what if you could, like, condense that value and carry it around with you, and you wouldn't have to do any work, and just show somebody how much gold you have, and things are going to start to happen? And it's so interesting that Jesus of Nazareth never uses either one directly. So when they ask him about the tax, he's like, anybody got a denarius? Because he doesn't have one. There is a disciple who carries apparently a little bit of money around, but it turns out to be the least reliable disciple, according to John. And he never writes. There's one time, in the Gospel of John, where he writes in the dust, but his followers wrote, but Jesus himself did not use these two primal technologies. I think because if you are a truly full human being fully alive, as Irenaeus said, you actually need not even these most remarkable kind of cultural inventions to bring all the good into the world that was meant to be and to experience all of God you were meant to experience. They simply are not necessary for the core creative purpose of being human. so that ultimate human one, who is our pattern for human flourishing, does not use them. I just find that fascinating and challenging.
Andy, there's just so much there to unpack. One piece is, I think for many of us going to church and seeking to engage in faith, there's not a real sharp distinction between faith, prayer, God intervening on the one hand, and magic on the other. So we are tempted to think of access to God, answers to prayer, essentially the same way that we would think about magic. It's just, it's okay that we do that because we're doing it in Jesus' name.
Yes.
And there could be real dangers there. Dallas Willard used to say sometimes, one of the greatest problems in human life is to have giftedness without sufficient character to bear it.
Wow. Yes. Yes.
And if God gives too much power and there's not the character to bear it, there's going to be a big problem.
Sometimes I think of the promise of magic as being able to make a change in the world without yourself being changed. Whereas all real transformation is at least accompanied by, if not preceded by, very profound formation of the person that makes you able to bear the kind of person who could bring change in the world. But yep. Magic is like, oh, you want, just learn the spell and you'll have what you need.
That gets so deeply to the biblical language around kingdoms, the kingdom of God and your kingdom and my kingdom and sitting on a throne and reigning. That really technology, and particularly the written word and money, are ways to extend my kingdom, the range of my effective will. What's that?
Speaking as authors who get royalties.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Where writing has probably involved more written word than money. but both of those are ways that we can seek to extend the range of our effective will beyond our bodies. But it can be very difficult to do that in ways that are ultimately productive and helping other people.
And isn't it just kind of crazy that, I mean, Jesus gets in, I mean, if it's right to speak this way, one shot at the redemptive mission, right? Yeah. He's got one life to live and he needs to step into history. You know, this is obviously putting this in maybe not the most theologically precise way, but history has gone awry. Israel has failed in its vocation to kind of restore the divine image in the world before the nations. Somebody's got to step in and do something. He's got a very short amount of time, you know, for some reason doesn't start till he's 30. There's a whole bunch of interesting, perhaps, angles to that. The clock is ticking. And wouldn't you think, well, then you better get a big foundation set up, like acquire some money.
Yep.
Wouldn't it be helpful to be the world's richest man at that moment? Like you can get stuff done, right? Well, you surely want to write things down. Don't just trust your disciples to remember what you said. Are you kidding? You know, get it in writing. If I can say this without being unfair, I worked for a year for a foundation, a charitable foundation set up by a very wealthy man. I'll omit his name, but you can go Google who it is. Who had a great deal of money thanks to productive work that he did in the world. I admire in many ways his skill as a business person and so forth. And he tried to put as much as possible into writing what the people would do after he died to get things done. Mm. And that is a worldly way of thinking about how you exercise power. And Jesus doesn't do it because he basically stakes it all on, if I live a life of complete connectedness to the Father and therefore a life of complete love at every moment and of sacrifice and not doing magic when you could. I could call 12 legions of angels, but I'm not. I'm going to let myself be bound and flogged and nailed to a cross. He's trusting that that's actually the way. It's crazy.
No, and the one time he holds a piece of money in denarius, it belongs to somebody else. The one time he writes in John 8, the story of the adulterous woman where he is scribbling in the dust, we have no idea. It doesn't say what he wrote.
It doesn't. We don't know the text.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah. It's just.
That is fascinating.
The wager of Jesus. And yet here, 2,000 years later, we are able to say empirically, this is the most consequential life in history.
Yes.
Right? Which is just amazing. But he. Could he have known? I mean, in one sense, as the Son of God, I suppose he did, but as a natural human being, how does he know that this wager is going to pay off surely when he's being taken to the cross above all? And the cross is like the ultimate now, the cross is technology, by the way. Yeah. The Romans were great at technology, yep, including the technology of torture, the technology of shame, the technology of public control, political power, all of which are embedded in the cross. Jesus is impaled on that. And, you know, the Romans get all kinds of power from crucifying people. But in the end, not as much power as the crucified one bears in the course of history.
Mm. Well, Andy, you have been very generous with your time, and I'm super grateful. I don't want to presume, but I'd love to ask one more question if you got a couple more minutes.
Of course, sure.
One of the very doable, for everybody who's watching us, thinking about how do I move towards flourishing in this world, practices that you write about that I do periodically, and anytime I think to do it, it's remarkable to me how helpful it is and how it changes my thoughts and the way that I look at people. Mm-hmm. You talk about a time when you were in an airport and you decided that you would look at people and simply hold one thought in your mind. And I'd love to hear you describe that and offer that to everybody who's watching us as, along with going outside first thing in the morning, yeah, a potential help in life.
Yeah. It was a winter evening. I was connecting through Chicago O'Hare International Airport. My flight was delayed. I had a couple of hours and I had not gotten any exercise that day. And I thought, you know what I should do is walk. I have time to walk the length of every terminal that are all connected from one to whatever it is through the end of Terminal 3, I think at that time. So I'm going to walk a couple of miles, walk, just get some walking in. And I thought, this is good for my body, but what am I going to do for my kind of mind and heart as I do this and soul? And it occurred to me, I'm going to be passing a lot of people. So I decided that I would try to pay attention to each one in a non-creepy way. look at each person as I walked the length of every terminal, like all the way down at gate, you know, 56 or whatever, all the way up and then all the way down the next little spur and back up. Look at each person and just in my mind, say to myself, affirm to myself, image bearer. This is an image bearer I'm passing. So, you know, I set out and within two gates, I've seen 20 people, image bearer, image bearer, image bearer. And I'm trying to just for a moment, just attend to every person. I did that for however many miles of walking, about an hour. And at the end of it, I was completely exhausted, not physically. It was like, I have never tried to pay that much attention to to crowds, you know. Mm. And what was so overwhelming, John, is just like all the conditions of life that you observe. And this is in an airport. This is a very select group of people who can be flying anywhere. And yet, the range of apparent health, the range of ages, the range of, well, I will say no one looked especially happy, but from reasonably content to really looking very stressed or lost, and the connectedness between a mother and a child, but then the sense of isolation of other people as you walk by. And it was just overwhelming. And to realize every one of these people refracts into the world an aspect of the divine that no one else can, even if they're an identical twin, they bring something into the world that someone you couldn't even tell apart at first glance doesn't bring. And they're all meant to bear the image of God. So image bearer, image bearer, image bearer. And honestly, I don't do it every time I'm in an airport because I can't stand to.
Yeah.
Like it's too much work.
It's effortful. Right?
It's like the opposite of magic, right? Effortless power. If I had just sat with a device, I would have felt, you know, very nicely entertained or whatever. And this like plunges you into, oh my goodness, God loves the world so much. He loves these people so much. Most of these people, one just senses, are so far from what is meant to be for their lives. I could also have gone through the same airport and including looking at my own face in the mirror and said, image breaker, like everyone is participated, unfortunately, in discarding and damaging, defacing the image of God in themselves and others. I'm glad you brought that up because I really think the remedies for our technological world are not they're definitely not just technology management, you know, like how much screen time am I allowed? Yeah. The remedies are regrounding ourselves. And actually, it's interesting that the two things that you wanted to hear about and that I want, that anytime I talk about this, I want to share are, like, it's regrounding in creation itself and what it means to be creatures. And it's regrounding in our proper relation to others, which should be above all reverence. Like, I just owe other people reverence because they are made in the image of God. And I need to remind myself of that and have a discipline of that. If we were to do that, and then also the renunciation of magic, which it doesn't mean I can't pick up these tools, because Jesus' own disciples did, right? And they did. Paul goes around collecting money, even as he's writing letters, right? Mm. So it's not that we don't then take up the instruments of technology and use them for good, as best as we understand it. It's just that we have before, during, and after those uses of the instruments, we're like reorienting our lives around creatureliness, around personhood, and around the renunciation of that which doesn't lead to life. Mm. And if we do that, then I think you can, in a way, do what you will with all these glowing rectangles. But frankly, what you will want to do is a lot less with them and a lot more with other people and a lot more risky, but a lot more meaningful.
It's such a powerful exercise, because my sense is part of what was going on with Jesus is that was so cultivated for him that he saw that image way that I see a face.
My gosh.
And sometimes I'll be reminded of it. Nancy and I have our plots already selected at a cemetery out here in California where we'll end up. And it sounds a little bit creepy, but we'll sometimes go sit there and have a sandwich and just kind of look out. And I was with a friend there. My friend Kevin was in town. And so we went to that cemetery. And there's a poem written by a friend of mine named Tom Schmidt, who has a reason to kind of revere that land. And one poem is called Mausoleum, and in a mausoleum there, there are urns, their ashes, with people's names and dates, but they are in the shape of a book.
Whoa.
So you see Andy Crouch with birth date and then the end of that life. And it's a very powerful reminder. Each of us is writing a story or part of a story that we get to impact the writing of. And Eleanor Stump writes about that in Wondering of Darkness, how each of us can be used as means in towards ends in other people's lives, but then we are the object of God's attention in the story that's being written about us. And I can look at that and be very moved, but then I can leave there and look at real people, and I forget that so quickly. And what I'm thinking is this person attractive? Do they look like they're successful? I have all kinds of thoughts that are a million miles away.
Yes.
That little phrase, image bearer, image bearer, image bearer, has a way of bringing me back to the person that I want to be when I interact with people. But the effort that's required for me just shows how differently my mind generally works.
Right, right. Leanne Payne was a teacher of the spiritual life who had some good things to say, and one really rocked my world and has ever since. She said, we either contemplate or we exploit.
Mm.
So we either behold, and that's, in a way, that's what I'm doing when I walk out in the mornings. I'm contemplating the world. I'm not there to find out what good it is for me, how I can use it, how I can bend it to my ends, what I can get done. I'm just going out to contemplate. And image bearer, the image bearer exercise, same thing. And magic is the quest to exploit the world. It's to get what I think I want.
Mm.
But real life begins with contemplation.
Such a great distinction. And exploitation feels like it's the road to gain, but it's never satisfied. So it always leads to loss. Contemplation feels like a kind of surrender or letting go. No, I'm not thinking about how I can do better. I'm just, and yet that's the way to life.
Crazy.
Yeah.
And yet, it seems maybe it's true.
Well, I'm going to leave it there. Andy, I could just talk to you for hours. I feel like I learned so much. I should be paying tuition or something. But I'm deeply grateful for you. I'm grateful for your friendship. I'm grateful for your mind and your heart. I'm grateful for your writings. And I don't do like book interviews or something. I've become new. But just As a reminder for anybody who's watching, if you want wisdom, the TechWise family, the life we're looking for, I love Strong and Weak, pretty much anything with Andy's name on it. Today, tomorrow, when you get up, go outside and experience the glow there before you let the screen glow. And then as you walk through the day today, just this little thought, image bearer, image bearer, image bearer. Andy, it's been incredibly rich. This has been alchemy. This is the kind of alchemy that matters. So thank you.
Thank you, John.
Hey, thanks for joining us. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes from John. You can also visit our website, becomenew.com, to access all of our videos there, or subscribe for the emails that go with each video. But my personal favorite way to stay in the loop with Become New is by text. We will send you a text message every morning that we release a new video with the title of that video and just the link to the video. So if you want that, you can text the word become to the number 855-888-0444 and we'll get those messages to you. If you've got a prayer request, there's a group of us who meet each weekday, Monday through Friday, for 1 hour to pray for viewers just like yourself. So you can text or email us your prayer request at 855-888-0444 or at connect@becomenew.com. Remember, the most important thing about your life is the person you become. We'll see you next time.